older than I, suggested that there were traditional baronial prerogatives that I had yet to take advantage of. Thankfully, Pentandra and Dara were watching my flanks for me. Several times, one or the other would see me in distress with some new predatory female and summon me for emergency counsel on the other side of the castle. Dara, in particular, was able to coax me away from their clutches without ruffling feathers. Pentandra did not mind the ruffled feathers, as she demonstrated when she found the wife of one of Arathanio's vassals doing her best to allure me into an upstairs chamber, and who had assured me she had neglected to wear proper underclothes. Penny said two sentences to her, maybe five words each. I didn't even hear what she said, but that woman curdled like sour milk and vanished into the night.
She should be ashamed of herself,
Penny said ruefully. To try to seduce the husband of a woman under her own roof is the height of tackiness. I feel sorry for her, I admitted, as I straightened my clothing. Her husband is a notorious boor. She's shopping around for a match for her daughter now, and she thought she might be able to persuade me to help her with that. I didn't do a damn thing to encourage her either, I swear, I said fervently.
I know,
Pentandra said with unexpected empathy. I warned you this would happen. Success is like catnip to women, and deciding to humiliate a military enemy and then throw a big party to celebrate your shiny new hat is just too much for them. What do they expect to gain? I complained. I'm not likely to leave Alia for the likes of them.
To some, that might be their goal, she agreed. But for others, being a powerful man's mistress is sufficient. For others, merely conquering a valuable domain is enough to flatter their vanity, she said, euphemistically. Now get back out to the Great Hall. It's safer in public.
The next day the magic fair opened in earnest, and the hum of commerce took the place of the music of minstrels in my ears. We were doing particularly good business in Snowstone, which was sold by official license only, though it lay about on the ground freely enough, and I have no doubt plenty made it out in folks' pockets. But the higher quality blocks, scraps from the ongoing castle construction, mostly, were selling by the pound to enchanters and adepts from all over the duchies. It had not been on the list of substances banned by the censorate yet, I knew, and several enterprising Merwini merchants were buying up all they could transport. I made a tidy sum on every sale. Sympathy stones were also in high demand. Once the utility of the mirror array was established, there were plenty of magi who wanted to experiment with the stones. The price had nearly doubled with the demand. I got a cut of them as well, through Bannermore. While the sale of raw materials abounded, so did the sale of finished products, I was gratified to see. Many of the enchanters present had brought along their wares for sale directly, and there was definitely a market for them among the curious. Master Andalnam's booth was impressive, and he offered a wide range of enchanted wares, from saddles that would not slip to belts that gave a man more endurance. The latter was a simple spell that banished fatigue, for a short time. Use for a day would require a day's rest, but for that day a man would be tireless, and he guaranteed the enchantment for a year. Business was booming, and I witnessed a lot of coin changing hands in his busy stall. He waved happily when I walked by. Since I had raised him to high magi status, Andalnam and his daughters had prospered, and he was grateful. The money he made on enchanting new mirrors alone had made him a rich man. He was not the only high mage in attendance by far, and one in particular took me aback. I was making the rounds of the new commons field when I spotted him in a knot of his followers and henchmen. Master Dunsellan. Mage Lord Dunsellan. Gone were the streaks of white he'd cultivated in his beard, though it hung from his face in a shaggy mop now. Gone, too, were the robes of a moderately well-paid government official. Dunsellan wore a rich mantle of ermine-trimmed grey, over a leather doublet and hose a courtier would envy. But he did not wear it well. As rich as his garments were, they were stained and slovenly. The roomy look in his eyes made him look more like a barfly than an adept. The men who surrounded him and attended him were a mix of common magi and mundane knights. The former seemed to be currying his favour, while the latter were more interested in gawking at the wonders of the fair. The man himself seemed a bit unsteady, his hands shaking part of the time. That wasn't a good sign. Nor was I fond of the arrogance he displayed when dealing with the vendors of the fair. He did not hesitate to scream obscenities when he was unsatisfied with their answers, their wares, or their prices. His pet war magi also seemed to like to try to intimidate everyone in their path. That might have worked back in Dunsland's rural fief, but this was Sevendor. We grew, I magi, here. The first time one of Dunsland's war magi got too close to the wrong mage, he found himself flat on his back, 20 feet away. The mage was Gareth, Bannermore's deputy spell warden and assistant in running the fair. Gareth was not a very large man at all, and his stature had kept him in part from becoming a war mage. But Gareth was a brilliant wizard, one of the most talented and intuitive I'd worked with, and what he lacked in mass he made up for in magic. Besides that, he was empowered with authority to run the fair. He'd objected to some rough treatment, and tried to find them each a penny. When the war magi had tried to get him to bend the rules with a threat of violence, Gareth hadn't appreciated it. Nor did the spindly wizard cower or capitulate. He was used to dealing with angry magi in his job. He didn't bother summoning help. He just drew a wand and blasted the man. The victim wasn't seriously injured, other than his pride, but his mates were instantly indignant. I'd seen the entire thing, as Gareth summoned fair wardens to pick the unconscious man up off the grass. Dunsellan's war magi were getting belligerent with him. They were close to drawing wands of their own when I came along. "Gentlemen, is there a problem?" I asked quietly, as the other three surrounded my employee.
"You stay the hell out of this," bellowed one man, a shaven, pated brute in a thick leather jack, without even looking at me. "We're about to teach this little pimple here what happens when he challenges one of his betters," he snarled.
"He'll get a monetary reward and a promotion, if I have anything to say about it," I continued calmly. "Might you consider the benefits of taking a calming walk before you do something rash?" I was trying to be polite about it. No one likes a brawl at the fair, save pickpockets and magistrates. But the cocky, bald bastard was feeling full of himself, and he whirled on me with a war wand in his hand.
"Who the hell do you think you are?" he demanded angrily. "I'm doing business here."
"Not without my leave," I pointed out firmly, using my commanding voice. "And as for who I am, I'm your host, Baron Minolin, the spellmonger. Perhaps you've heard of me."
"You are the—"
the thuggish leader of the group began, when he saw the shaking heads around him. He quickly realized his mistake. I was indeed the spellmonger, and that meant something to him. His manner changed. He put the wand back in his belt.
"My mistake, Baron," he said angrily. "But this pimple here just threatened Cordy for no good reason at all."
"Actually, Excellency, it was because he threatened to beat me," Gareth supplied tiredly, pushing back the brim of his broad-brimmed pointed hat. "Not just threatened, but put his hands upon me. Master Bannermore was quite clear about how I should respond to such a provocation," he said evenly, as he glared at the ruffians. "I didn't use anything lethal."
"Indeed," I agreed gravely. "You were right to do so, and your friend will be no worse for wear, and perhaps a bit wiser when he awakens. In the future I counsel more caution and less boldness while in Sevendor. Perhaps you tolerate such bullying in Greenflower. We do things differently here."
"You're just going to let him blast poor Cordy like that?"
one of them asked, aghast.
"He should show a little more respect to his betters. Cordy is a blooded war mage.
And Gareth is the deputy fair warden. I consider his response measured, under the circumstances. But then this was a first offence. Another infraction will result in him being thrown from the fair." I turned to go. He wouldn't let it go.
"Mage Lord Dunsellan was right about you,"
he muttered, just loud enough for me to hear it.
"Was he now?"
I asked, turning back around. I was suddenly interested. The old man was still behind a curtain of toadies. That would be my generous and forgiving nature, I gather.
He said you were going around arming the weak with magics too potent for them, the leader said, scowling. He appeared to be the worst sort of mercenary war mage, the kind I don't like to work with. I see that is true, he added, glaring at Gareth. He leaned on his staff defiantly, his hat cocked back, a defiant gleam in his eye. But he didn't look as imposing as the bald thug. I was impressed to see that the sneer didn't intimidate the scrawny-looking young wizard. Gareth wasn't a war mage because of his size and lack of killer instinct, not his lack of courage. He'd stared down High Magi who'd questioned his authority before. He put up with me. He put up with Bannermore. In the middle of the fair, even a gang of war magi did not disturb him overmuch. I find wisdom a compelling element in who I choose to invest witch stones, I said mildly, and perhaps Master Dunsellan is correct. Perhaps I have over-invested some folk with stones who do not deserve them. That's Mage Lord Dunsellan to you, another of the rough-looking war magi nearly shouted. And that's Baron Minelan to you, Gareth shouted back, with the support of the gathering crowd. It parted a moment later. Master Dunsellan had finally caught on that there was a commotion involving his men, and he was coming to their support. He approached angrily, until he saw with whom they were arguing. He stepped in front of them at once. "Mage Lord Minelan," he began with affected charm. "It's Baron now, as my man was just reminding your men," I answered flatly. "Baron Minelan. It has been too long since I've seen you." He oversold it, trying to counteract the anger that lingered between his men and mine. "It is a pleasure to see you visit my humble little land," I agreed quietly. "Your men, however, have forgotten some basic elements of hospitality, like not threatening the fair wardens." I shall speak to them at once," he assured me, looking at Cordy, who was just starting to come around. "What was his offence?" "He got belligerent with one of my people," I dismissed. "He'll be the wiser for it." "I chose my men on the basis of their loyalty, you understand," he apologized. "They can be a bit zealous in regard to my dignity." "I chose my men on the basis of their competency. Master Gareth was doing his job. Your men did not obey his authority. As it is a first offence, I'm willing to put it in the past. For now," I said, nodding to Gareth. "So, what do you think of Sevendor?"
"Oh, it's a lovely little place," he agreed. "The Snowstone Mountain makes it quite majestic. I've never been able to cast spells so easily before. You must tell me how you did it."
"It does grant a lot of aid," I agreed. "As to how? Well, it's complicated."
"Which is one of the things that intrigues me about it,"
he nodded, putting his hand on my shoulder.
"Was Irionite a factor?"
"I did have the larger piece of Irionite," I agreed, "but it really is quite more convoluted than that. It had to do with the birth of my son and some magical complications, a complete, if fortuitous, side effect of the spell I employed."
"Come now, Baron,"
Dunsellan said, his eyebrows furrowed.
"I understand wanting to protect such secrets from the common rabble, but you and I are men of scholarship. Surely you can give me some idea of how you went about it?"
"Not really," I said, feeling wary about the way he asked. "I will write up a monograph about the experience some day, perhaps, but there are far higher priorities."
"Higher priorities? Than this? This is the most remarkable magical feat since the Magocracy, and you're worried about a few goblins?"
"A few hundreds of thousands of goblins," I corrected, "and the Snowstone has been a valuable resource in that fight. But thaumaturgy must be behind all of the other issues before us."
"They say that there were jewels discovered in the mountain."
"A few interesting specimens, yes," I dismissed. "I am having them evaluated by the Karshak and the Alka'alon. I'll let you know if they find anything."
"Yes, please do. But researching the mechanism for a transformation of this magnitude is clearly a profoundly important undertaking."
"Mage Lord, right now building my castle, ordering my domains, and defending the crown are my most profoundly important undertakings.
right behind my wife and children. Surely you can appreciate the importance of such tasks?
Of course, of course. I spend far too much time with such crass business myself, he admitted, but such a discovery, on top of the great advantage you have with that mighty sphere of yours.
He got a faraway look in his eyes as he watched it bob serenely over my shoulder.
It truly is magnificent. It seems unfair, somehow, that it was granted to one who lacks the experience to appreciate and study it properly.
Unfair? I asked, surprised that I'd have to defend my ownership of the sphere again.
How unfair? Perhaps unfair is not the best term, he admitted. It just seems that such treasures would be better fitted to wiser heads.
You fault my wisdom, Mage Lord, I asked warningly.
What? Nay, not at all, Baron. You have shown adequate resolve in establishing the new orders, and there is no doubt you have accomplished much here. But by accident, not design, a man with deeper knowledge, more experience.
A man such as yourself, I supplied. I was getting angry.
I am not alone in this belief, he assured me congenially. We older and wiser heads have been discussing the matter quietly. A great many of us feel it would be in the best interests of the orders, and even the kingdom, for you to give the device over to one of us. Such artifacts are not meant for the young and brash, you understand.
And just who are these other adepts who feel I have power beyond my means? I asked coolly. Dunsellan must have been going mad, if it was not clear to him to see how distraught I was becoming. He was blinded by his own opportunity. I could see it in his eyes as they tracked my sphere back and forth.
Master Inraig, Master Gamethiel, Mistress Rerkard, among others. The leading minds of the magical community, he bragged.
And not a high mage among them, I pointed out. A highly artificial division, Dunsellan insisted, sounding offended.
Something simply must be done about the way these witchstones are apportioned. It's abysmal, with common war magi getting precedence over serious scholars. When I agreed to allow you to undertake this experiment, my dear boy, I never imagined you would take such liberties, he lectured. I had intended on these duties being handed over to those who are best equipped and trained to deal with them.
Those magi in your own personal circle, then, I replied with a sneer. I knew of the adepts of which Dunsellan spoke. They were indeed highly regarded scholars, but their fields were utterly pedestrian and uncontroversial. Master Gamethiel's field was magical fungi. Witchstones would be wasted on such hide-bound sages. I needed magi who could put magic to good use, not study it to death. They were overlooked for stones for good reason, Dunsellan.
Good reason? Master Inraig was assistant headmaster at Alar Academy for 4 years. Mistress Rerkard was the deputy court mage for the Count of Eremon. These are magi of rank and prestige.
So what magic have they done? Asked Lorcus, pushing his way through the crowd, eating an apple. Lorcus loved apples.
These fat-arsed adepts who want to take the sphere. What spells have they done? It's not about practical application, the old mage insisted. It's about earning the respect and...
It's about the naked application of power, I corrected. I've started to learn about power in the last few years, Dunsellan. Real power. Not magic, but the power to get things done. Like gather an army, or fight a war, or build up a domain. Magic can be helpful for that, but you have to be willing to use the power you have to get things done.
Well, obviously, Dunsellan snorted.
Capitulating to you and your colleagues' demand for power they have neither earned nor merited are not effective tools of my power, I explained. They, and you, are bureaucrats, first and foremost. Not even serious scholars of magic, I said critically. I've listened to these older and wiser heads for years, and usually they say nothing of consequence when it comes to how magic affects the real world. He took a breath for a rebuttal, but I didn't let him. The way magic is done is changing, Dunsullan, and not just by letting you bully your neighbours with your power. With the censorate gone, magic can do things again, real things that affect real people. You received your appointment to court mage because of political connections and because you were good at organisation, not because you were that great of a mage. You got your witchstone because you were at the right place at the right time and open to a bribe, and you gained much from that. But when I hear tales about how you use your powers to loot the people you conquer and steal away their women, it makes me sick that I've granted you such power.
Hey! Barked one of Dunsullan's war magi. You can't speak to...
Just say another word, Gareth said, holding a short, nasty-looking wand on the man. The Baron was speaking.
I tolerated you when you came begging at the door because I felt you were a fool spellmonger who had lapped into a cache of witchstones, Dunsullan said, all trace of civility lost. I expected Harterion to roast you alive and confiscate your trove, to be honest. When he didn't, I was surprised. But I never imagined that he would allow you to keep such potent artifacts.
I don't think he's in any position to demand them, I pointed out. Nor are you. My power here is sufficient to keep that from happening.
You are not the only power in the kingdom, he riposted. Even you have to answer to the crown.
And not even the crown can demand my sphere, I countered. You worked for Rard for years. Do you think he's likely to alienate a powerful political ally for the sake of a couple of tired old farts like you and your colleagues? He has a war to fight and an entire kingdom to run.
He gave me charge of magic for a reason. Mere political expediency, sneered the old man, shaking his head. Just because you and your so-called high magi have power, they are still no better than trained adepts with years of experience. Rard will see this in time, as you inevitably fail.
He sounded quite sure of himself.
You had better hope he doesn't, Lorca said, amused, or you'll be finishing your memoirs in Gervani. You stay out of this, spy,
Dunsullan spat.
Yes, I'm aware of your so-called agent, Menelan, sent to spy on me and my lands, when I've done nothing wrong.
If you've done nothing wrong, then you have nothing to fear from one of my agents, I corrected, and he was sent at the behest of the crown you are so eager to set against me. Your actions have attracted attention to the High Magi I would rather avoid, Dunsullan.
Me? I've been nothing but magnanimous in my retirement.
Conquering your neighbours isn't magnanimous, and it isn't retirement. When you go out of your way to wave your phallus around to torment the people you've conquered, it makes us all look bad.
I haven't, he struggled.
I think you are done here today, I finished, simply. I'm a hair's breadth from demanding your stone, and I'm certain that I'll regret not taking it later. But I'm going to give you one last opportunity. Go back to your lands and be content with them. Despoil your own people if you must, but your days of private warfare are done. Pack your belongings and head for the gate. I want you out of Sevendor by sundown and out of my barony with all speed.
Chapter 21 Mage Lord Draenus. I wish I could say that the fair was uneventful after Dunsullan's expulsion, which had proven popular. The man was a pretentious ass and had offended plenty of folk, but that wasn't the case. There was another wizard there with a political purpose. Mage Lord Draenus had also arrived at Sevendor just in time for the fair. Draenus' fame had risen quickly after he'd prosecuted his claim to his family inheritance. With some adept legal manoeuvring, he had been re-ennobled and had claimed the domain left to him by his grandfather, a sizable estate he'd had to chase a cousin off of to claim, defeating a brother or cousin or someone in a duel in the process. But his biggest prize was ahead of him. He was a strong claimant to the county of Morros, which was about a third of northern Rhaemir, just shy of Wenshire. It was a rich land, one currently held by Draenus' younger half-brother. After holding a witch stone for only a few months,
Draenor's domain in Morris was now well fortified, and he was here hiring mercenary war magi and purchasing magical weapons in preparation for a showdown with the current and acting Count of Morris. It was widely speculated that he was going to start a civil war over his half-brother's rule. But it was more accurate, my agents had discovered, that he was preparing for a number of eventualities. He was adopting a political, as well as military strategy, it was said, bribing or threatening his brother's key vassals into inaction in advance of his move. He'd already issued one unanswered personal challenge to his younger brother, but the acting Count of Morris was no fool. Morris was a prize too great to risk in a single fight, even if Draenus was a court wizard who did war magic, not a war mage who was aspiring to an administrative post. In addition to hiring mercenaries, Draenus also wanted to curry my favour. He sought me out in my pavilion, near the front of the fair, four gentlemen in tow. Unlike Dunsellin, they weren't looking for a fight. On the contrary, they were looking for allies.
I have heard it said that the Crown has taken notice of my being raised to High Mage, the tall, neat-looking Remiran gentleman said, after preliminaries were observed.
I wasn't wildly enthusiastic about Draenus, thanks to the headaches his political ambitions had caused me, but he seemed a solid enough fellow on his own. He had come into his own as a mage lord with style, affecting a new device of mage's stars and a bull's head, the traditional badge of Morris. It has, I agreed, and it is worried, or at least some dangerous parts of it have. Having a few mage lords around gives the kingdom variety. Having an entire important region under the control of one, they're concerned about that, I won't lie to you. He seemed realistic about his chances at taking his patrimony.
They needn't be.
I have no quarrel with the royal house, as long as they do not block my path. I'm not a fanatic, he emphasized. I want what is best for the people of Morris. My half-brother is a lackluster count at best. My father would never forgive him for some of the duties he's neglected. So, is the king going to stand in my way? He's not inclined to, I think. Depending upon just how loudly you sing Rard's praises as you cut off your brother's head. That's their largest consideration. How loyal are you to the regime? I answered that you would be most loyal to those who were most willing to see you in your seat.
That's not far from the truth, he agreed, nodding.
I don't want to put a circlet on my head just to have the king take it off with my head. I'm even willing to be patient if they need more time to adjust to the idea. I think we can work something out with them, I offered, cautiously. They aren't terribly fond of the current management. Morris has been quite reluctant in providing troops for the war effort, for instance, and it is said that some of his supporters murmur against the legitimacy of the regime. If you were to make some public declarations of support and loyalty, it might improve your position, but I'll warn you. If the Crown thinks you are an obstacle, they will remove you, and having a witchstone won't do you much good. They will assassinate you.
Then I shall endeavour to be the most loyal of supporters of the royal family,
he said, with a smile that was just a little too wide. I could see how he'd be a good court wizard.
Can I count on the support of the spellmonger as well?
If you're asking for gold or troops, I warned, then no. I don't want to appear to give my support that way. It would put the orders in a vulnerable position, not to mention complicate the local political situation. On the other hand, there are many of your colleagues and admirers who devoutly wish to see you installed as a count. I'm certain you could raise funds or secure men that way.
I was more looking for your endorsement than your alliance, he said quickly.
I am a politician, not a war mage. I know that military action will probably be required, and I've hired a war mage to oversee that. But taking a county is not like conquering a domain, Baron. It requires cultivating the support of the barons and great lords of the region, who look to the count for aid and order between them. I've secured unofficial pledges of support of nearly a third of them now. But many won't commit to your cause until they know that you'll be successful and unsanctioned by me, I said, nodding my head. That makes sense. But how do you propose to convince the rest? I'm assuming that your brother has his own supporters.
Also a
About a third of the great lords, he acknowledged. Some will support him beyond death, thanks to their allegiance to his mother's house. My claim will rest on the desires of the remaining third. Most do not know me, but have no particular love for my brother. I am cultivating contacts within their courts, reaching out to them with gifts and influence where I can find it. But I am still not ready to press my suit.
You can have my endorsement for what it is worth, I shrugged. I haven't met your brother, but he has a poor reputation. You, on the other hand, have very little reputation, I'm afraid.
Oh, I know, he shrugged in return, but I have time to change that. The Moros Northern League meets in a year and a half, when the great nobles of Moros and Remsferar convene at Lintos to discuss the affairs of the realm. It's usually a merely ceremonial meeting, but that's where I can press a challenge, a legitimate challenge, to my half-brother's title. Hopefully by that time I will have made a much bigger name for myself. And just how do you propose to do that? Because I want the job as your court wizard, he answered calmly. I figure a year of showing the most powerful mage in the kingdom what I can do will be better for my reputation than charging into battle. While I was taken aback by his boldness, I was also impressed by it. I had let it be known I was looking for a new court wizard for Sevendor, and there were several magi here specifically to interview for the position. None of them were seated high magi. By taking the position, Draenus would be giving up the small fortune he could make with his witchstone on his own time. He was dedicated. I liked that. He also had experience as a court wizard, and while some of the other candidates also did, Draenus enjoyed a solid reputation in that position, and not just for his administrative skills. By all accounts, Draenus was an adept worthy of the title. Intelligent, educated, wise, and resolute. And not just a little politically adept. Unlike Lorcus, he typified the other stereotype about Remirans, the calculating opportunist. I had need of a calculating opportunist. You're hired, I decided, for 6 months. A trial period. There will be some formalities, you understand, mostly security issues, but it will give me a chance to evaluate you, and if you deserve my endorsement by the time of the meeting of the Northern League, I'll be glad to give it to you. That meant I had to turn down the next most qualified candidate, a woman named Merilyn. But Baron Arathaniel had been asking for a recommendation for a court wizard. I would send her to him, and give her a witchstone to seal the deal. You never interview for just one job. The highlight of the fair was, of course, the spellmonger's trial, wherein any common mage who could pony up the entrance fee could try their magic and their wits in a contest to win the greatest of all arcane prizes, a shard of Irionite. This year it was a captured stone, cleansed and ready for use, not one of the better Alka Alon stones. I'd been quietly trading out the old shards for the more robust Alkan stones, as I was able to manage. Some of the more prominent magi already had improved their powers that way. Azar and Bendenal the Outlaw, for instance, each bore one of the stones known as Horka's Seven, and they were laced with Alkan magic. But for a contest like this, a smaller shard of Gavani Irionite was sufficient. As it was, there were nearly 300 magi who wished to try themselves in the challenge. We had changed around the nature of the challenges the contestants would face, inviting other magi to contribute to the cunningly crafted set of obstacles. This year even the Karshak were involved. Nothing intentionally fatal, but you'd have to be a damned good mage to get to the top of Matin's Helm and collect my pipe from the courtyard at Lesgathiel. Retrieving my pipe had become the traditional object of the challenge, and I appreciated the bit of tradition. The impressive thing about the event wasn't the contestants, although they were as fierce and determined as I'd ever seen the field. It was how I got the pipe to the summit of the helm in the first place. I had Dara take it, on Frightful's back. Master Andalnam had been working with Dara and the Alkan emissaries once their falconry project had reached maturity. He and his daughters had crafted and enchanted a handsome harness for the bird, in its large form. And Frightful's large form gave her nearly a 40-foot wingspan, tip to tip. The harness managed to secure a saddle to the bird without restricting her movements.
The massive, silver-hooded raptor certainly wasn't happy with the arrangement, but there were apparently spells on the harness to soothe her about that, too. This was her big debut. She'd taken some secret test flights, but the spellmonger's trial was where she would show off her giant falcon to one and all, for the first time. All three emissaries were standing by, eagerly watching the result of months of work with my apprentice and her bird. Dara landed at the appropriate moment in my speech to the contestants. I was warming them up, getting them enthused and frightened of the challenge ahead, and stirring up the spectators when I called for my pipe, and Dara drove Frightful down onto the commons, landing as daintily as a 500-pound aerial predator could. The crowd scattered, and there were screams when the great falcon landed, but mostly there were just gape-mouthed awe. Frightful was beautiful and terrifying at the same time. Dara had donned leather trousers and a jerkin, as well as a special, short, flying cloak for her appearance as the Hawk Maiden of Sevendor, and she looked like a princess as she brought me my pipe from the back of the hawk. I showed it to the awed crowd before handing it back to her, and watching her and the bird launch into the air with a mighty beat of Frightful's wings. In moments, they were winging their way to the summit in the distance. The crowd went wild with amazement over the sight. The interest in the challenge was dwarfed by the intrigue over the giant falcon. After receiving word from Dara that the pipe was ready, I started the contest officially. Then I spent the next 2 hours answering questions about the giant hawk. I gave quite a speech about the clear advantages in battlefield reconnaissance and commando missions. Being able to strike at a foe from the air was a potent capability. Even though Dara had only been flying on Frightful's enlarged back for a few weeks, she had already mastered the art enough to look graceful. The other mage lords were enraptured. The mundane lords watched in dazed awe as Frightful cut through the air with the majesty of a destrier in full gallop. Suddenly, about the same time, they all realized their castle walls were not high enough. Everyone was impressed by the huge raptor. The three Alka-Alon emissaries, in their gorgeous humanoid forms, were politely indulgent in explaining the technique to the interested, in as close to layman's terms as they were able to manage. But the result was the same. Giant falcons were now on the battlefield. I explained the innovation to all. Eventually, as the birds breed true, there'll be great natural eyries of them throughout the Colleens and elsewhere. Tamed to the Jesses, and enchanted by competent brown magi, these birds will be able to aid us in the war. They have 40-foot wingspans so far, and can carry about 200 pounds aloft. We're still fiddling with the details, but we hope to produce a manifestation that will be a furious foe on the field. We'll augment their talons with steel blades. We'll arm their riders. They can fly beyond the sight of man or goblin, yet see all below. This, my friends, is one of the wondrous gifts of our Alka-Alon allies. I led them in a cheer. It helped that there was a lot of strong ale flowing. But the first glorious sight of the giant falcons would be the talk of the Bantal for years to come. Is Lady Dara to be in charge of them, then? She's been instrumental in the effort, I nodded. It has been her drive and her willingness to risk her own life in this undertaking. Right now, the only thing of danger in the skies over the penumbra are dragons. Now we can meet the enemy on the wing. Magi in the air will be an advantage in the war that the enemy cannot match. In time, I foresee an entire corps of riders winging over battlefields, bearing messages and gathering intelligence, and striking at the enemy, if need be. I went on to explain that the new Hawkmaster, Arkor, was lending his masterful knowledge of falconry to usher the process along in a useful way. Between Arkor's avian wisdom, the Alkan's magic, and Dara's dedication, seeing Frightful a wing promised to be the first of many times that men looked into the sky with awe at cloud-spanning wings. So far, 5 of the things had been subjected to the enchantment, and the second trial was planned soon. It was hoped to encourage them to breed in their giant form soon. Hawks mature far faster than dragons. Dara's handling of Frightful in the air was very encouraging, but finding adequate hawk riders was going to prove a challenge. Dara basked in the attention she received upon her return. Normally shy in public, bossy in private, The bald girl seemed to warm to her role for the first time since her return from Barrowbell a year before. She had learned the fundamentals of magic faster than even Rondal, once she'd mastered the art of reading, and she was progressing through her second year of study effortlessly. She had also matured as a young woman. The responsibility implicit in the program had forced her to learn to apply herself in ways that I think surprised her. I was gratified to see it. It had not been without difficulties, but she had done splendidly. I had high hopes for my hawk maiden. The winner of the challenge was a young mage from Rhymir, named Darrow of Quinns. Unlike most Rhymiran magi, he hadn't come from an old imperial house that traced its lineage back centuries. He was a fisherman's son who had apprenticed to a sea mage, then taken his journeyman's papers inland and journeyed. He'd been successful enough as an itinerant mage to ride to Sevendor on his own horse, and he would ride away again with a witchstone in his pocket. He'd bested his competition by keeping his wits, moving fast, and casting the right spell at the right time. At the banquet that night in his honour, he kept the crowd breathless as he described his challenges. He was a handsome and engaging kid who made me miss Rondal and Tyndall, who were off chasing goblins in Gilmora. He also had an eye for the ladies. When the time came for dancing, he passed over several eligible young women for his signature dance to ask Dara, who could not have been more shocked. My apprentice had grown by more than wisdom's measure, however. She was just not yet fully aware at how much of an attractive young woman she was, and the attention turned her into a blithering idiot for the rest of the night. The remainder of the fair was filled with parties. First, the Order of the Secret Tower hosted an elite reception for all High Magi in the luxurious mansion Pentandra had built north of town. It was a lavish affair, featuring the finest delicacies from all over the kingdom and beyond, but especially Rhymir. I chose that evening to announce the appointment of Draenors as my court mage, to the pleased astonishment of the crowd. It didn't take long for people to realize the tacit endorsement that gave him for pursuing the county of Moros in a year or so. That earned both of us some pleased and enthusiastic congratulations. The High Magi supported one of their own becoming a mage lord at that rank, second only to dukes below the king. That was real, secular power, the kind of power that Magi had not wielded since the Majocracy. It helped his cause that Draenus was personable and very popular. Not a war mage, he nonetheless mingled with our profession's martial wing comfortably. Not a scholar per se, he had several friends who were respected scholars, and as there were only a handful of seated mage lords, he helped set the style in a group too small for generalities. The following night was the fete that had become known as the Foot Wizard's Ball, a rowdy counterpart to the High Magi's reception. It was held in the Enchanter's Guild, which had become a delightfully shabby neighbour to Penny's mansion. The hall was large but haphazardly put together, the product of a committee short of funds and quick to adapt their plans to available materials. But it was a hell of a party. I'd contributed 2 full barrels of wine to the festivities, and there were plenty of other donations. Nearly every wizard was invited, no matter how low of stature or power. The festivity was promoted as a mask, and all manner of grotesque and sublime masks were employed to conceal the identities of the participants, and keep their sins clandestine. Lorcus, of all people, seemed to be at the center of the party. Though he was now a high mage and a war mage of some repute, he had cultivated a network of foot wizards and spellmongers over the years who looked to him for inspiration. Unlike the usually conservative stereotype of the imperial Rhymiran Draenors epitomized, he typified the other extreme of the culture, the mad Rhymiran. He drank and danced and kissed and even fought once when he overheard a rudeness and decided to intervene. He was the perfect combination of scoundrel and gentleman, and he charmed every woman there, Alia included. The next night there was a far more staid celebration thrown by the arcane orders, open to all, but with strict rules of decorum in place. The hall that the order had constructed was now the home to Sevendor's mirror, the official mirror. There were several unofficial mirrors that fed into and out of the domain now, but the service had proven popular, not the least because it was a paying job for magi between assignments. That was the other import of the event. The Arcane Orders Ball had become the event at which to announce taking on apprentices, opening new practices, forming new partnerships, and awarding apprentices their journeyman's papers. I capped the evening with the surprise granting of a stone to Master Andelnum's eldest daughter, who had also received her journeyman's papers that night. The public oath-taking was particularly good showmanship, and I followed it with a little speech about how ethics were at the root of the responsible use of magic. That didn't stop plenty of people grousing that the award had been pure favoritism, as there were dozens of more worthy candidates for becoming high magi than she, but I had grown used to that kind of grousing by then. It really didn't matter who I gave a stone to. If it wasn't you, you bitched about it. That was human nature. The last night of the fair featured a fete sponsored by what would afterwards be known as the Seven Door Town Council reception. It was a mixture of local lords, local wizards, and prominent townsfolk who were eager to celebrate the end of the fair and begin counting their money. Bannermore sponsored it, of course, using his cavernous warehouse to do so. Once it was cleaned out a little, there was plenty of space for a casual get-together. I used the occasion to formally sign and present the completed charter to the town, which brought everyone some cheer. Sevendor was a free town, more or less, able to chart its own course to prosperity with only minimal guidance from me. Bannermore made a speech, a couple of the other members of the council made speeches, and everyone was very merry afterwards. I wandered outside after a few hours to get some fresh air, then spoiled the endeavour by filling and lighting my pipe. I was joined a few moments later by Baron Arathaniel and his son, who had the same idea. "Lovely little fair here," the Baron grunted as he unfastened his trousers. "Nothing like Chepstone, of course, but exotic. Those giant falcons of yours will be the talk of the Bontal, Minolan." He grunted in satisfaction as an evening's worth of wine left his care and ran out into the road. "I think it's remarkable how quickly you've taken this holding from poverty to prosperity," admired his son, Sir Arliston, who lit his own pipe. He was a man of 22, only a year or two running his own domain, and he was starting to appreciate such things. "All it took was a divine level of magic and an embarrassing amount of coin," I admitted. "I have a lot invested in the place. I'd like to see it flower." "So would we all," agreed Arathaniel. "Sevendor has proven a mighty and unexpected friend, and you've ruled with more wisdom and maturity than I would have given you credit for, Lewin knows," the old Baron admitted. "You are not just a worthy war leader, which are common enough, but you are also a passable manager of estates." "I know how to hire good people," I shrugged. "Something you taught me." "As strong of a friend as Sevendor is," he continued quietly, "even good friends look twice when they see something like that on the horizon," he said, nodding toward the scaffolded side of the mountain, visible in the moonlight. "You've not just built a fortress on a mountain. You've made a mountain into a fortress." "We were speculating about its size earlier this week," the Baron's heir agreed. "It's enormous. How many men will it be capable of supporting? Fighting men?" I took a deep breath. I had been expecting this sort of question. "About 2,000, I answered, earning meaningful looks from both of them. "Most of the barracks' chambers will be within the mountain itself. The exterior halls will be focused on military fortifications. The intention is to withstand a siege for over a year." "Who in Zax?" swore Arathaniel's son. "There isn't a castle in the Bontal that could withstand that kind of siege." "The likely foe isn't Flaria," I chuckled. "Eventually I anticipate the dead god's reach to extend even here. It is that enemy I keep in mind while I fortify." "Yet a castle that can stand against the dead god would shake off Flaria like a flea," Arathaniel observed, "or any other force I can imagine."
"Even the king," Sir Arliston said, very quietly.
"I would hope never to be in such a position," I said calmly, "but I suspect that if I held it, that the new Sevendor castle would withstand even royal might, for a while."
"You will be a powerful friend to have, then, Minolan," Arathaniel said, the repercussions of such a conflict playing out in the old knight's mind. "Remind me ever to stay on your benevolent side."
"I have few ambitions in the local region," I pointed out, trying to sound reasonable.
I have none on my neighbour's lands, nor are my heirs likely to. We have larger priorities than mere conquest. I could have taken Pozendor on a pretext, had I wanted war. Or Pozendor. I didn't. True enough, Arathaniel said, relaxing after he tucked away the family jewels. I do not fault you for your precautions, my friend. They're sensible. But I would not be doing my duty to my people if I did not investigate. No offense taken, I assured him. If I had a powerful new neighbor, I'd be curious as to his ambitions as well. But I have to do something with that mountain, and my current castle is too small and inadequate for my needs. So this was my best solution. I would much rather support the stability of the current regimes than impose my own, I added. Well spoken, murmured the son. Since you broke the warbird's lock on trade and rebuilt that bridge, the whole valley prospers, thanks to Sevendor. We are grateful even as we are wary. But, as I am certain a wizard of your caliber has foreseen, Sandaria intends to wrest from Sashtalia more of what was once ours. I do not say when, but soon. I shrugged. I have no love for Sashtalia. I would support you in a war. Already a piece of Sashtalia interests me, I said, not specifying why. The fewer people who knew about the snowstone outcropping there, the better. I certainly would not hinder your plans. I might even help, though Sevendor's strength lies not in lances. That would be appreciated, spellmonger. Arathaniel grunted. I remember how quickly you went through West Flaria, and how you attacked the dragon. I'm sure you could lend us some useful advice in a war with Sashtalia. Just be certain it does not interfere with the wider war effort, I warned. My priorities remain the same, gentlemen. Understood, Minolin, Arathaniel assured me. We are months, if not years, away from such a campaign, though. We merely wanted to be certain of your support. The man sent me eels, I shrugged. I care not what happens to him, and I like eels. But I share a border with him, with one of my new estates. I'm certain that will play a role in this maneuvering, as long as the Baron of Flaria minds his own business. Oh, I think you taught him as much in Pozendor, chuckled Arathaniel, and before that with the Warbird. We will settle accounts with Flaria soon enough, but one serpent at a time. I avoided the fairgrounds the day after the closing ceremonies. Too many people wanted to linger for the chance to speak with me, beg a boon, cajole a witchstone, invest in a surefire proposition. I stayed in my tower and got some work done, including adding the new high magi I'd made recently to the marble board in my workshop. Dara was nearly useless. I had to tell her 3 times how to spell a name when it came to writing them on the marbles. She was lost in thoughts of soaring heights and a Remiran wizard's dreamy eyes. I tried not to fault her too much. I knew that feeling. I was interrupted midday by one of the few people with the clout to get through the guards at the entrance to the tower. Lady Fallowen it was, in her human form. She had no problem charming her way through.
Mage Lord, I bear a message from the council, she said,
after a businesslike bow.
Now that your festival is over, they would ask that you produce for them the Gurvan you hold prisoner.
Gurkarl? Why, yes. I do suppose it's time to bring him forth from hiding. I shall make the arrangements. He is in the care of a religious order at the moment, safe and well cared for. But I shall bring him to Sevendor. I have a place where he can be kept safely, without fear for his life.
Your dungeon?
She asked uneasily. Alka Alon did not share the human appreciation of captivity. The idea of a dungeon was dreadful to their sensitivities. Nay, my lady, I have comfortable quarters prepared, but in secret. It will take a while. One does not lightly move a goblin through the kingdom these days, but my people are able to complete the task. As soon as he is here, I shall let you know. But why the sudden interest?
There have been raids by the Gervani tribes in the Colleens, she explained. This autumn, there were attacks on the valley folk, the Pearwoods clans, the Kasari, even the Alka Alon. A Karshak settlement was attacked in the eastern wilderlands. The raiders all bore the markings of the dead god, she said, in a quiet voice, like a muffled bell.
And do you think that Gurkarl can speak sense to them?
It is our hope he can act as our emissary, if he finds such a position agreeable.
More of the council's strategy of containment, I said sourly.
To understand one's opponent is wisdom, Mage Lord. The Gervani are a tortured, tormented people, even before Sharul's cruel priesthood enslaved them. Their hatred is not without cause, nor is our response not without guilt in our role in their history. We hope that by speaking to Gurkarl, we can better understand the Gervani people and find some better solution to their woes than the banner of the abomination.
That is indeed a wise course of action, I agreed, almost reluctantly. I will undertake the necessary arrangements. Was there something else? I asked, when she began to leave, then hesitated.
Personal matter, Mage Lord,
she began cautiously.
I had occasion to notice that one of your fellows has developed an interest in me,
she said, embarrassed and confused. One of my fellows?
One of your vassal knights,
she corrected, after searching her mind for the correct term.
Sir Riff. I noticed him lingering near me several times during the course of the fair. He seemed to be haunting my steps, Mage Lord.
And you find the attention offensive?
The knight has been nothing but courteous,
she said, shaking her head prettily.
I just do not know what to make of his interest.
He likes you, I shrugged.
Likes me, Mage Lord?
Yes, he likes you, I repeated. He has formed a romantic attachment to you. She looked shocked.
But Mage Lord, he is Humani.
He is male, I countered. You are female. Beyond that, all bets are off. Forbidden love has a long and valiant history with both our peoples, I teased.
Mage Lord, I am the daughter of...
And he's a barely literate country knight from the Riverlands, I agreed. But he has been enchanted by you.
I swear, I sang no spell.
I couldn't help smiling. Not intentionally. But surely you are aware that the form you wear now is very aesthetically pleasing to the Humani eye. She blushed.
We endeavored to cultivate a comely shape.
You succeeded. So don't be alarmed if you attract the attention of men like Sir Riff, and men of lesser character, while you wear them. Perhaps some warts, suggested Dara unhelpfully, or scars.
That won't be necessary, I said curtly. Think of it as a sign of good Humani-Elka-Alon relations. Sir Riff is a gentleman, and he would never do anything untoward. But he does hold a strong admiration for you, my lady. I had wondered why he lingered in Sevendor so long after his service was discharged. I thought it was to cultivate my favour. I am enlightened now.
You would send him away?
Have you any reason for me to, my lady? I asked courteously.
Why, no, he is just very persistent.
We Humani are only here for a few short years. We have little time to waste. If a man sees a vision of perfect beauty, he will certainly do what he needs to in order to remain in her sight. But if you object to his presence...
No, I shall endure it,
she said, after a moment's confused thought.
It is an odd attraction, but not entirely unwelcome,
she admitted guiltily.
It's just...
She looked distressed.
What?
I asked, alarmed. Dara looked up with interest.
What?
She demanded.
He sings to me,
she said, as if she were ashamed, in that low, unartful, beastly, sweet Humani voice.
He sings to me,
she said, scandalized.
He asked me to walk with him under the moonlight last night, and I accompanied him to enjoy the stars. Yet he began singing in that voice,
she said, her face screwed up in emotion.
I knew not whether to laugh or to cry. It is not too bad a voice, I suppose, for your folk, but...
But perhaps the way to your heart lies in poetry, I suggested.
Spoken words? I might enjoy that,
she admitted. Then I will counsel my vassal accordingly. And do let me know if he becomes a burden to you, and I will return him to his estates.
Thank you
Mage Lord, she said gratefully. Poetry.
When she was gone, Dara sat looking off into space, her brush and marble held in inattentive hands. What are you dreaming about, Feathers?